good afternoon, everybody. It's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me on today's episode of I Don't Care with Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you joining me. And today I'm very excited about my guest. He's someone who I've gotten to know over the last few months, and I'm very excited to be doing some things with his organization coming up in the next couple of months. Please help me welcome Dr. Hubert Zajcek of Health Wildcatters. Hubert, good to have you on I Don't Care.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to having you more involved in our shop and talking to you here.
Sounds great. Hubert, tell my folks a little bit about you. I found your background incredibly fascinating. And tell everybody about Health Wildcatters.
Yeah. I'm a physician by training from Austria. I came right after medical school, spent a few years in science at UT Southwestern, was on faculty there, had NIH grants, all that good stuff. So kind of on purpose stayed in science, basic science, really. So really labs. But got to see a lot of stuff in that time period and enjoyed it greatly. Then I got my MBA at SMU, and that kind of opened the doors to entrepreneurship for me. And so that's on the personal side. Worked for an incubator for a few years and then started Health Wildcatters 13 years ago. So here in Dallas, at the time there were a few healthcare only seed accelerators in the country. And we were one of the first. And on the concept of Health Wildcatters, we are a healthcare seed accelerator and seed fund. Backed by now over 200 angel investors and family offices. So it's angel investors and early stage VCs are involved in this. We invest in pre-seed healthcare startups of all stripes, which includes medical devices, of course, health IT, digital health, pharma, tech-enabled services, healthcare consumer goods. So we're very broad. Of the four partners, we're all angel investors. We invest in each of our little funds. And so the idea is kind of like if we get together, not just the four of us, but you know, 20, 30 people a year that invest a few high risk dollars. And then we look at the best startups that apply to us. We get over 500 applications every year now and whittle that down to basically 10 that we'll work with in the fall for 3 months. So it doesn't end at 3 months. This isn't just investment, it's a relationship. And we have 100 programming points. We make a small investment in these startups. We might make a second investment, but we're not going to be their funder. We're really just there to help them calibrate how what the market expects, how to sell, tell their story, and also connect them to some high-value players that could help them with sales or whatever it is they need. So that's quite actually different for some of these startups.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, let's get started. I've got a few questions that I'd like for us to hit over the next half hour. The first thing is, you know, you and I both know healthcare is incredibly regulated, it's capital intensive and very relationship driven. So what does a credible healthcare founder look like today? And how can a first time entrepreneur really build credibility quickly?
In healthcare, our entrepreneurs are more likely to be in their 30s, 40s and above than in their 20s. Now we've had successful and wonderful people in their 20s join as well with startups. But I think this stems from the fact that number one, healthcare is more complex. So you kind of have to have seen stuff. Our typical entrepreneur has seen things, had a professional career or has a professional career and is now willing to risk their own time and money to start something, to do something about the things they've seen out there that don't work properly or that they think they can improve upon. That's number one. So somebody who does not have a healthcare background whatsoever, it gets a little bit more complicated with such individuals. And I would say that would not be our typical entrepreneur these days. We've had a few, but there is an element we like to see someone involved in the team that has a deep healthcare expertise of some kind that's relevant. We certainly want fresh blood and fresh ideas and new ideas and different backgrounds involved. That's all great. But ultimately, somebody on the team needs to have really, really understood the problem personally or professionally or both. But professionally is not so optional because, you, like you said, there's a lot of trip hazards. And you can't just say, oh, we'll do this FDA thing later, or we might skip it or something. So
So I know you've seen hundreds of pitches over the years. So what's the most common founder blind spot that ultimately kills a promising healthcare startup and idea?
I think one of the most common things that happens that makes the pitch fall flat on its face is the fact that most founders want to talk about their technology for a very long time in their pitch. And the reality is, well, of course, let's be real, it's very, very important, but it's not important for me in a 5-minute pitch to understand every little bit about your technology.
Yeah,
I need to understand the problem and to understand rudimentarily anyway, how you're going to go about solving this problem. So your solution, your secret sauce. Most founders though want to just like talk your head off on, and then it does this, and then it does this, and then also it does this. And by the way, you can all, I'll care in the next conversation or the conversation after. But it's a big turnoff for a lot of investors when you don't, when you go over time, number one. So we are very, very rigid on that. And that, that is also one of the reasons our startups can show up in a lot of pitch competitions do really well. 5 minutes is over and they are on their last slide finishing their sentence. That is a huge deal for a startup to be able to do, to be aware of that. And then also, what are the elements you need to cover in a pitch? And they're just not all about your solution. They're about the regulatory landscape, your IP situation, your sales, your go-to-market strategy. So there's your team. So a lot of these things matter just as much. But like I said, most founders are in love with their technology, and it's just not not a wise thing to dwell on that for too long in the first encounter.
Yeah, it's funny that you're basically pointing out somebody's passion and excitement about their idea can sometimes be a real barrier in that, because as you said, you've only got 5 minutes or however long you set, and you've got to be pretty succinct about, you know, what is the problem and what's the solution that I'm proposing, right?
We love passion. There's, I will always say, I mean, unless you're the most passionate person in the room about what you're doing, you know, we're already in the minus. How do you expect your investors to be even more excited about it than you? So you need to be the big cheerleader. But if this falls into the category of real world and realism and also respect for others, you going on and on about your thing, why do they need to know that the three different ways in which this material can be fabricated? It's not relevant for a first conversation. We can, in due diligence, those things are being covered. So it's really a test, and a 5-minute pitch or initial conversation tells you a lot about how this is going to go. Because even if you do have that massively amazing new innovation, but you have no concept of how to bring it to market, were you expecting me to invest? I can't. I have to have you be realistic about that. And so that's, there are a lot of little things that we pick up on in the pitches that tell us things. And that passion can also mean that you're a passion warrior. By the way, some people say this and mean it in a good way, and it can be read both ways. You can say something along the lines, well, I will never stop. This is my mission. And believe it or not, that is not necessarily a positive thing. I need you to, everyone tells you this is nonsense, stop, look around, maybe pivot, do something else, or adjust. And so sometimes also it can mean somebody has already got enough resources. So you're now on part of this journey that will take 30 years and probably never get anywhere because you're passionate about it. So it is unfortunately true that some people can just be so in love with their technology that they don't attribute much value to the rest, when you got to be able to get it in front of patients. You got to get it through FDA. So a lot of other things matter greatly.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, in some of the organizations that I'm advising in my practice, I'm finding the very same thing. You know, people are very passionate about a solution. And I had to tell one company, this problem, there are multiple people solving it the exact same way you are. You're not bringing anything new to the table. And they just didn't want to hear that. They were so dead set on, hey, we're going to solve it our way. I said, but your way is not new. And so I'm sure you and your partners find a lot of times that you're just coaching these entrepreneurs to continue to hone a solution that's going to make sense for an investor and for an end user, right?
Yeah, I mean we in the program, what we aspire to do is to expose them to any conceivable blind spot they might have, and those ideally the team has at least two members. I think it's hard to do something completely by yourself and to be the production manager, the IP person, the salesperson. Obviously, you got to wear a lot of hats, but it's really, really great if you have one other person and you've got some complementary skills going. But so we try to shine a light on every conceivable blind spot. And we're doing this in a group of 10 or so, 8 to 12 startups a year. Mm-hmm. And so you might see something in somebody else and say, oh, actually, I need to pay attention to that, even if you weren't asked. Or you see others pitch and you say, oh, I'll never do it that way. And then you realize you catch yourself doing the same thing. It's like, oh, okay. So you learn a lot through observing the others and being in this cohort as well. And then, but most importantly, everyone's got something where they're not the best at. And so that's where, even worse, and maybe they haven't thought about it. And certainly during the program, many of our startups have pivoted their business models, the prioritization of products, their approach to sales, even FDA, you name it. Because you just need as many good people around you that can give you their honest feedback and then make decisions. And that's just not something you can do in the wild by yourself very often. And you also want to be around people who are got that business sense. So don't take it the wrong way. I spent 10 years in academia. I spent many years getting my medical degree. So I value that process highly, highly. But you need to be around people who have sold businesses, who've built businesses, who've invested in them, who had to deal with the realities of sales and how hard some of those things, marketing. So a lot of things that you will not be exposed to if you're in the scientific fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. So not every healthcare startup actually needs venture capital. So how should founders really decide whether to pursue VC or strategic investors or other funding models?
Sure. I mean, I don't think there's a single answer, and it's a really, really, really broad question. Mm-hmm. But number one, yes, not everyone needs to raise capital. And not everyone that comes to us needs to raise capital. This is, accelerators solve a lot of, can help you with a lot of different type of issues. Generally, we would love for you to get as far as you can with your own money so that when somebody invests, you know, you've created value. You've created something that they can look at and say, wow, this is something. It's very rare that you can show up with a sketch on a napkin and say, here's my idea and now give me money. I know people who can, and that's because of who they are and because of what they've done before. You know, we just had Mark Cuban here. I think Mark Cuban could walk into the office and say, Hubert, here's what I'm thinking about. You want to invest? I'm like,
plenty of investors,
But I know many other entrepreneurs, and many of those are mentors in our program, that have been very successful, mm-hmm. that are willing to give back. They see themselves 20 years ago, and they're still like, I can come and talk to these guys and love the experience and love to be able to do that. And so so most of the time, it's really going to be about the hard facts of what you've created already on your own. And I mean, one good example would be around software. If you're starting a software company, but you can't code or know how to get AI to code for you properly these days, that's an option. But you're not the person going to be doing it. You're like raising my money and then hiring coders, or then I'm out. You can't do that. Like, somebody's got to have the expertise, not just the idea. Maybe later when you're famous, like other people, you can do that. But early on, like, you've got to have the ability to do it. And so that's a good example where that'll be really difficult. If you're a software startup, I need you to show up with the software, not the idea for the software. I'm thinking,
sure.
And then you might tell me, oh yeah, I came up with this 6 months ago. And like, well, why didn't you spend these 6 months creating it then? I mean, seriously, that's not, and now you come in and now you want somebody else to do work. So obviously there are many, I'm overly generalizing here, and there are many reasons why you might need specialized. Anyway, I'm getting at is, what is it you have created? What is it we're investing in? What is it you have? And with software, it's the software. And so you got to have something there. You might need some specialists that refine it or whatever. All understandable, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've got to see somebody that, number one, has skin in the game, but that they have that specific, some, at least some specific expertise. As you said, not just an idea. So very interesting. So we talked a little bit about sales and bringing things to market. What are some of the more successful early revenue strategies that you've seen founders use?
Well, I mean, this is so different depending on where you are. Obviously, we have pharma companies, and there's almost no chance to make any early sales. And with device companies, you start getting into possibly paid pilots. We have a startup right now that's doing that. They've got a amazing technology that deals with monitoring, specifically in breast cancer, monitoring the tumor to see if chemotherapy works or doesn't work in about a third of cases. It doesn't work properly. You want to know as quickly as you can, so you can switch this patient over to something that will work for them. And time is money, and time is life, life saved. So incredibly important. They've been able to prove that they can do it, and which means they can't sell devices until they are approved, but they can have paid pilots, which means a hospital or a group says, we would like to test this device on our population, and we'll share our data, and we're willing to, I mean, it costs money to make this device, so we're willing to pay you for it. A startup just doesn't have the money to give away 50 devices, and so they're willing to, and so that can sometimes create early revenues when and if appropriate, and you know, you gotta have something very convincing, but if you do, that can be enough for you to do more stuff with. So that's an interesting thing that is not as easy to replicate. Yeah. You got to have a very convincing technology, of course. Others, you know, if you get into software, of course, there's a million different things you can do to get some early revenues. And again, if you can have a group of people that really need your help with it, that your solution is a good fit for, you can probably find a few early believers also amongst your investors. So your investors might be able to point you towards some customers, or your customers become investors, which is another thing that can be a positive.
Yeah. And I'm finding that with a group that I'm working with out of California. You know, they've got a number of health systems out there testing their software, and some are buying in, some are pointing them to other investors. So yeah, that's just another example of a model there. So I want to shift emphasis a bit, and let's give some entrepreneurs who might be listening maybe a few tips and along the way. So let's just rapid fire this. Here's one thing, and I'm calling it, you know, my product is amazing syndrome. Everybody who sees it loves it, but they don't have any paying customers. So what's the problem here? What's the deal?
I mean, your product is ready, like this on the shelves, and
yeah, you've got a product, but nobody's buying it. I mean, you know, have you really found a solution to? Have you identified a problem that really has a solution, or is your solution new?
So, you
what should they be asking themselves?
It is and stems from the problem that SBIR grants, which are for commercialization of products and driving the innovation commercialization forward for American innovations. These applications very often had a very weak segment about how to sell the device and how there is demand for whatever it is you're producing, device or whatever else you're producing. So the iCore program was created to force, not to force, but to allow a mentor, an academic, and an entrepreneur, so three people together with a little bit of funding to do some customer research. And generally in that program, you will interview, I think, 50 or 100 potential customers and ask them questions about your product or your solution. And this can either create a real nice body of work to say there is a need for this product. Plus, of course, these are all potential real customers very soon, you know, not just hypothetical, real customers. Because you're making something that has to do with toothpaste. Well, you're supposed to go to dentists, and you know, so you go to relevant people in your field, and if they think this is something great, and they'll become customers. So you're kind of preloading your customer channel, but more importantly, you're getting feedback, and it may turn out to be this product is in head lice treatment that you need to. You get all sorts of inputs from your actual customers, and so this is a fundamental thing that you need to do. It's a hard exercise. It's actually not easy to do 50 or 100 interviews. It's groundwork. But it's very, very important. And a lot of people bypass that and say, oh, well, I'm the Dr. So-and-so, and I know there's a need for that. Well, doctors are not exempt from this syndrome at all, just to be clear here. I'm one, and I'm not bashing on them. Obviously, it's a noble profession. But I've seen a lot of things that doctors developed and thought is the greatest thing ever. And they may be even implemented in their own practice to the nth degree, and they're very successful in it. They just can't find another doctor that also wants it, and they're just absolutely beside themselves. And it turns out that their workflow was completely different from everyone else's, and it was made custom made for them, the solution, and others just don't buy into it. So it would be very, very helpful to have gotten this kind of insights early, and or to make the adjustments necessary so that your solution that's tailor-made for you, inclusive of other 49 people's opinions as well, so you can broaden it a little bit and say, oh, you know, maybe we need to make this interface a little bit more. I'm talking like software type of program, or like this, or also include this. And this is what I hear. So it's not just your own little bubble that answers the question, because they'll often ask their own staff and colleagues and everything. They all nod their heads, and they're all friendly and nice, but you need real feedback. So,
yeah, you're stuck in an echo chamber. You're hearing what you want to hear from people who are giving you what you want to hear. Yeah. So a lot of entrepreneurs think, okay, hey, I've got investors, I've got more money, you know, it's going to fix my problems. So what problems don't money fix?
So first of all, it's really good if you have raised capital and you can onboard trustworthy professionals that can help you on the journey. So our model is very much along the lines of you, the entrepreneur, don't need to become an accountant and a FDA specialist. As a matter of fact, I really don't want you to be. You need to be a manager. You need to understand enough to understand and then delegate to good people. So one thing that money can't solve is falling into the hands of bad people. Either bad people as in investors who can absolutely make your life hell, or service providers who are not ethical. Not just can they ruin your business or set you up the wrong way, they also can drain your bank account with, you know, just all sorts of extra fees for this and that, and we gotta book some more hours to look into this. An accelerator is a little bit of nothing's perfect, but a little bit of a protective device in that. I mean, if it's just me out here and I'm dealing with, I don't know, I don't want to bash any trade, but like some non-savory, let's just say lawyers. I have so many lawyer friends, they all understand that they're don't play by the rules, and I've seen it. Number one, it can absolutely set up the wrong way and screw everything up, cap table, everything. You might have to just shut it down. So there's some people who will just say, yes, I can do it. And then they try to figure it out and they do it the wrong way or do it for the first time. We want tried and true people to work with you. Now, it doesn't need to be the principal of that practice, but I want it to be people that have a good reputation. And of course, if you want to save a little bit of money, you get the junior folks involved in the grunt work, but you got supervision and you get a brand name of a law firm that backs you on the product. On the bleeding you dry on money side, in accelerators, we have relationships with any conceivable trade. And some of those are also sponsors of ours. So they're supporting directly your participation in this accelerator and do other things. But others are also just good players in the community. And so accelerator allows you to be not just the only person that now goes and says, hey, I need some legal services. And heaven forbid you fall into the hands of someone who mm-hmm. is behind three months on their mortgage payment, and it's now you get to pay that because they'll make sure they bill you enough for it.
Oh yeah.
So because if you go to someone that has a relationship with us or any other organization like us, then the implication is like, well, this organization hasn't spent years to build a relationship with this accelerator that might be a path to many, many clients or whatever else they wish to have, sales, to screw it up with one startup where they just start draining their bank account. Because when they do that, as an individual, you by yourself, what are you going to do? They hurt you. Mm-hmm. How are you going to have any recourse? It's usually not legal recourse you have anyway. It's anything that can be justified. Obviously. But if you're telling me that somebody mistreated you, I mean, they know it'll come back to me and not just me, my staff, our circles. And I mean, in the best case scenario, there's not going to be any referrals to you or worse. You have hurt my startup. You have hurt me. I'm an investor personally in each of my startups through my fund. You've hurt my other investors. It's my fiduciary responsibility to help my investors get a return. How could I justify having a friendship or relationship with a service provider that's not doing the best for our startups? So, I mean, I have an obligation not to be in business with them or refer to them ever. And so it keeps everyone pretty honest because the dishonest ones aren't going to spend years in a relationship to get a quick hit and get some money. They're going to stay with us. And so all the brands you see associated with us are that and some prior brands as well. So and so that's a big deal for me because okay. we spent very little time on these, you know, kind of you think they're just check boxes. Yeah, I got to have a lawyer, I got to have an accountant. But having a good one or at least one that knows a startup scenario as well is huge. So it's not just having the biggest name on the block, having someone who's a specialist in startup accounting. Startup law,
sure.
Be appropriate okay. with your resources. They're going to extract from you in exchange for their services.
Excellent. Okay. All right. Last question. You know, you and I both know that healthcare entrepreneurship and really any entrepreneurship in the beginning is incredibly brutal. It's incredibly intensive, long cycles, lots of uncertainty. But what are the traits and the habits of those entrepreneurs that really sustain success over the long haul?
Well, I always say that shy of being a soldier, policeman, fireman, or on the front lines in an ER, it's the noblest thing you could do. And it's also the riskiest and, to me, the most American thing to do, to just create mm-hmm. something, to observe there's a opportunity, there's a problem, and to go do it. Our country does afford the easiest way to do that. I know it's not easy, but I have lived in other countries, and I know a lot about other countries' law as well and how that works. And I can guarantee you this is one of the easiest countries to try something, to do something, and be encouraged along the way. The traits you need ultimately are you need to, and this is something it's a personal question, but you need to be in a position to do this all in. And that may mean that you may need to wait until your kids are a little older, or maybe your spouse is in a situation where he or she earns a steady paycheck and you have saved some money to make up the bogey. So it needs to be the right time. And of course, nobody wants to wait, but you can work on those situations and you can work on that situation and seeing what would be appropriate. So you just need to have a mind for it. It's not going to happen in 3 months or even 6 months in almost all cases. And so this is going to be years and years and years that you will be in this. As much as you think this is a 2-year engagement and you'll sell, you have to be realistic around the realities of startups, especially in healthcare, which take an even longer to an exit than other startups. And also towards be immune to comparing yourselves to the people that we hold, that we see in the media all the time. Of course, the most successful of the successful will show up on TV, and you'll see Elon Musk, and you'll see Zuckerberg, and all these amazing people who are absolutely deserving of our applause. And I don't want to discourage you to aspire to be like them. It's just what I'm going to say to you would be that the odds of you hitting it like they did, because there's also a good bit of luck involved, are like being struck by lightning 6 times or winning the lottery 5 times. It's one of those things. Nobody wants to hear that, but you have to be realistic, right? I mean, if it's too hard to conceptually understand that, then just imagine the most beautiful person you admire, and you just look at them, and then you look at yourself and say, "Well, we're gonna have to work with what I have." So, given the fact that I'm not them, how can I succeed? So, what I'm trying to say is, like, some things are God-given. You're gonna have to pay attention to that. I certainly not gonna get you anywhere to be complaining about your situation or tell me, or not me, but you know, walking around and telling people how this and this and this hardship happened. It's expected that you, and by the way, we run a very compassionate shop because it's about that nobility of being an entrepreneur. This is a safe space. This is where we can talk turkey about hard things. But at the same time, you have to be very resilient. And so you only are the only person that really knows that. And I encourage you to be very realistic about that. And then if you aren't, then get yourself a co-founder and you work like really well together, gel well together, or find a third person. So there are ways to fix all these things. And you'll never catch me discouraging someone from doing it. But I have seen a lot of people, of course, who were... it's a combat sport. We're heavily injured, let's say, in the process. It was really, really hard on them, and sometimes there's really nothing even I can do about fixing it. So we're all about helping them, but building them up, giving them the confidence. Most importantly, just like these examples of these super successful people, read their biographies and understand that they had the worst of the worst times as well, and they picked themselves back up from that. So that you have to not let others get in your way on that. That is fundamentally important. And these people, they all did it. They had hit rock bottom or hit some really hard stops. And I'm not going to say you can do what they do, but I'm going to say you can do it. And you just need to understand that there's a lot less written about when people had it hard than when they were successful, had billions.
Very good. Well, hey, I do want to mention the Texas Healthcare Challenge coming up in April. Again, really excited to be a part of that as a mentor and on the planning committee. So Hubert, tell my audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is our 8th hackathon. Our hackathons have always been about solutions. So even if you have heard about hackathons, you know it's like you're spending 24 or 48 hours there and noodling on ideas. But you probably think that everyone's like typing away like crazy, programming things. Ours have actually never been that. Ours were always about solutions. So people getting together, talking about a problem, coming up with a solution and sketching it out as much as you can in 24, 48 hours. And this year, we also have a two-week prior information day where people can already mix and mingle and start working. Most importantly, this year, actually, for the technically, it was available last year, too, but probably for the first time, all of you have heard that you actually don't necessarily need to be a programmer anymore to program things. And so we have tools available at this hackathon that will enable you to build apps and do all sorts of things, AI tools, of course, where you don't need to know a lick of programming languages. But that's a big deal, because now we can actually do a hackathon with people who don't know how to program, which is really, really cool. Now, despite that, some solutions may be other things like hardware. So we have even an AI software available to help you build a hardware tool virtually, spec the pieces, price it, do all those things. So again, amazing tools available to help you build whatever it is you want to build. And again, it's about solutions, and then there are prizes. What I will say is this: there are what you come away with is hard to say. It's exciting, it's fun, it's exhilarating, and just breathtaking. The one thing I can promise you, I don't make a lot of promises, but this promise I can make is you will likely never forget that weekend. And what I mean is, you might 30 years from now, if somebody asks you, have you been at a hackathon? You will tell them about it, even if it's the only one. So you're in for something that is potentially life-changing. You might start something. Certainly life-changing, because you'll meet amazing people and be inspired, hopefully, and all sorts of other potential things could happen, from finding a job to coworkers to whatever. You might be inventing something that can have an impact on the world, but you will not, no matter what you do, even if you don't win a prize, I think almost anyone wins something, but even if you don't win a prize, you will not forget that you spent this weekend in Dallas in 2026. So that's a promise, and I'm holding by that. I'm waiting for somebody to knock on my door when I'm 90 and say, I still remember.
Well, I tell you, I'm looking forward to my first hackathon. I can't wait to be a part of that. You and I are going to be seeing a lot of each other over the next few months, and I'm really pleased by that. So, Hubert, thanks so much for joining me today. This was really, really great. I hope this gave some entrepreneurs some insight and investors some things to think about as well. So, again, thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for putting this on and for having me. Thanks for volunteering at the hackathon and continuing to give back to healthcare after such an esteemed career that you've had. And so I look forward to seeing more of you too. And let's see what new startups get born this weekend in April.
That sounds great. Hubert Zajcek with Health Wildcatters, thanks for joining me on today's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. And we'll be talking again next time. Take care.